Always appreciate your time, Ed. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Catherine. How are you?
I'm good. It's a biggie today with the Chinese president making his first trip to Europe since the pandemic and goodness, all the other things that have happened in the world since then. How significant is this?
Yeah, it's a major trip for Xi Jinping. It's really highlighted both division in Europe over China, as well as these sort of worsening tensions that are really boiling over again over China's trade with the West, as well as these ongoing concerns around Beijing's support of Russia, despite, you know, the invasion of Ukraine. So just to go back to the start of the week, Xi's first stop on Monday was in France. He met with Emmanuel Macron, the French president, as well as Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission. And this saw these meetings saw the two sides, China and the European leaders, really just, for the most part, speaking past each other, which has become increasingly the norm with Xi Jinping's overseas trips, especially to anywhere in the West. So, you know, the European leaders were reiterating warnings that they've been making over the last 9 or 12 months around Europe is needing to, well, try to protect itself from what they fear around a wave of cheap, high-tech Chinese imports, especially in areas like renewable energy and electric vehicles. Now, for months, the US in particular, but also European officials have complained that China basically has this nefarious industrial policy, drawing in foreign investment, obtaining key technologies, and then basically offering massive subsidies and cheap loans for its own domestic producers, and then dumping excess supply on foreign markets. And so they've started a bunch of investigations into China across those key areas of solar, wind, and electric vehicles. And Xi Jinping has basically just hit back, saying that firstly, there's no such thing as an overcapacity problem or any sort of excess supply problem in China. And secondly, he made the point that these industries in China will not only sort of support countries in their green transitions, but they should also, because they're cheap, they should also help alleviate the pressure of global inflation. And so we've just, like I said, to return to this point where these major economies are just talking past each other and nothing appears to be close to being resolved. There was also the slightly bizarre trend of Macron saying that Xi Jinping promised not to sell weapons or dual-use technologies to Russia. So these are products that can be used for military purposes. But in his public comments, Xi Jinping made no such pledge, and he reiterated that China has had nothing to do with the sort of the origin of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so I think really a trip that was a lot of optics, a lot of it was sort of for domestic audiences in Europe, as well as from Xi Jinping's point of view in China, but nothing really resolved.
Then on to Serbia and Hungary, where I understand the Chinese leader received a much warmer reception.
Yeah, so he's seeing sort of like-minded leaders in those two countries. So before he actually arrived in Serbia on Tuesday, he wrote a letter that was published in a major Serbian news outlet in which Xi Jinping slammed NATO over its bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade back in 1999. So just for a very quick bit of background, it was a while ago. NATO has always said that the bombing of the Chinese embassy, which happened obviously during the war to protect Kosovo, was an accident. But in Serbia and China, it's still something that's really deeply resented and still a major event in those countries' history. And so the timing of this letter was no mistake. Tuesday marked the 25th anniversary of that event. And analysts sort of say that for Xi to really focus on this moment in NATO's history while traveling to Serbia and while traveling to Hungary, this is all part of China's aims to kind of exploit what they see as key differences that exist in Europe, particularly along these fault lines around Russia and the US. Serbia and Russia are both sort of marginally seen as more, Serbia and Hungary rather, both seen as marginally more pro-Russian and just independent from the rest of Western Europe in particular. And that's something that, you know, Beijing supports. They want to see countries with much more independent foreign policies. They don't want to see countries locked into what the US wants and what sort of pan-European countries want. And to that end, you know, Xi was in Hungary on Thursday. He praised Viktor Orban. the Hungarian Prime Minister. He praised him there for pursuing an independent foreign policy. He also has announced a bunch of deals that will help the local economy, so sort of rewarding countries that have a friendlier ties to China. And so, look, just stepping back, you know, a few experts here have pointed out that despite this trip, there's just something of a real stalemate on the diplomatic front between China and Europe. Xi's government and Xi Jinping appears no closer to ditching, leaving kind of its economic support for Russia. China's obviously resisting any pressure to change its trade practices and industrial policy. And meanwhile, it will continue, it seems, to find friends in countries in the developing world in particular, who do, have see the world in similar ways and have also drifted further away from the kind of policies that the US and the West are pursuing.
Now let's get an update on India's marathon election, please.
Yeah, so look, this has turned a little bit ugly over the last few weeks. So just for a quick bit of background, we've got about, I think, 3 weeks to go in India's 6 week parliamentary election. And I think we spoke about a few weeks ago, Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his ruling BJP party, they're tracking towards a third 5 year term in power. They have a very popular support base for the sort of Hindu nationalism and policies that have boosted economic growth in India. And while things are, looking pretty grim for this loose alliance of opposition parties, and Modi seems to be tracking very strongly. Modi and the BJP are also doubling down on their attacks against India's Muslim population. This seems to be an effort to mobilize even more Hindu voters who make up about 80% of the country's 1.4 billion people. And so for just a few examples, Modi himself at campaign rallies, he's been referring to the Muslim minority as infiltrators. He said opposition parties want to steal from Hindus. And pander to what he says are religious minorities. And look, for many of Modi's critics, both inside and outside of India, this has obviously, been something that they've seen as quite appalling, these attacks. There are also deeper concerns here that if Modi keeps up this kind of rhetoric, it will just become more and more normalized. And these sorts of attacks will filter down among, the many hundreds of millions of his very devout supporters. As to whether it's working, it's difficult to tell. There are reports of some low voter turnouts in some areas, which would potentially indicate a bit of a blow for the BJP and for Modi. But India, really, it doesn't allow any sort of exit polls. So everyone's just going to have to wait until the end of the month and the results will be revealed in, I think, June the 4th.
Just a couple of minutes left, Ed, to talk about the banning of a popular protest anthem in Hong Kong.
Yeah, so Hong Kong appeals court on Wednesday, they've effectively supported local officials in banning the song, which is called "Glory to Hong Kong." Now, this had become a popular anthem during the most recent round of really big protests in the city in 2019. The local government had sought a preliminary injunction to ban the song. The appeals court agreed. It said the song had been intended as a weapon that could propel violent protests. They also said that the song had been, and this is a quote, "powerful in arousing the emotions among certain factions of society." So this is, of course, look, just the latest episode in a much broader period of suppression and dissent, suppression of dissent and suppression of free speech and democracy in Hong Kong, which has obviously over the last few years already seen most of the city's leading dissidents and activists either jailed or have gone into exile. And for a city now, this Hong Kong is now living under this just sweeping national security law. It includes penalties of life imprisonment for activities that can be deemed by the court as political dissent. So people singing the song or performing the song will now be at risk of being in breach of those laws. And just finally on this, the ban on the song has also created a headache for some of the international tech companies. So the likes of Google, which owns YouTube, as well as Spotify, these companies always espouse free and open internet and free speech. But eventually, it seems they'll actually have to do what the government says. So just another way in which Hong Kong becomes really more and more like China.
Thank you so much, Ed White, who is with the Financial Times, who's based in Shanghai.